Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, July 23rd. And today we're going to continue our series of shows about World War II. We'll be talking with our good friend Barry Jacobson. You know, the last time we spoke with Barry, we did a political show. We talked about the political leaders of World War II, like President Truman, President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Churchill, and so on. Today we're going to be looking at the military leaders, and I have a funny feeling that Barry has a lot of stories about these amazing people on all sides. We're going to look at the U.S. leaders, we're going to look at the Allies, we're going to look at the Japanese, as well as the Germans, the Russians. I think it's going to be an absolutely fascinating show, so take note. If you're like me, I've got to take a lot of notes when I do a show with Barry, because this is one of the best informed people that I've ever spoke to. So we're going to do this. We're going to take a little break, we're going to hear from one of our sponsors, and then we've got Barry on the other side. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. You know, I've lived in Texas now for 30 years, 32 years to be exact, and I never recall having allergies in the summer. Usually when it's 97, 98 degrees outside, we don't have allergies. Well, this is the exception. I'm fighting allergies, so bear with me today as I'm fighting some of these unusual summer allergies. Let me say hello to my good friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well. We're getting a little bit of heat wave here in San Diego. It's gotten up to a really miserable 99, 98 degrees, which with very little humidity isn't too bad compared to most of the country. But for San
it
Diego,
is really,
it's fairly warm.
Yeah, it's global warming all over, Barry. it's global warming all over. It's summertime, so what do you expect, I guess? But this is very warm. I mean, what, it's 104 in L.A., I think, or something like that. I mean, and then they have some fires too. I know you're in San Diego, of course, but I just a friend of mine just told me that they're getting a lot of smoke and heat in LA from some of these fires. So it's a very unpleasant time right now to be in LA, Barry.
Well, you know, it's always an unpleasant time to be in LA. Yeah, some of the worst traffic in the country. Every month it seems to get hotter and hotter, which some call global warming, but I just call that summer.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that one. I think I'm just going to call it summer. You know, somebody told me a story one time. It may be a joke, so please correct me, Mick, because it could be a joke about the Golden State of California. They say that they want to divide, you know, the state into different states because it's really very big. So they want to divide it. But the reason they can never agree is because nobody wants L.A. So, you know, when...
Yeah, it's the state is large. It covers most of the West Coast. If you think about the East Coast, how many states make up the East Coast and how many states make up the West Coast, the majority of which is just California, it easily could be three states. It could be a state centered on San Francisco, one centered on Los Angeles, or perhaps two states, perhaps south of the Tehachapis, which is the mountains north of L.A. Unfortunately, that put San Diego in the same state as L.A., and if there's some way we could possibly extricate ourselves, you know, that'd be to the better, I would think.
Yeah, I think it would actually be, in all fairness, I think it would actually be a better run state if it was really at least three, perhaps even four. I mean, when you think of the Electoral College, you know, you have 55 electoral votes. There's a lot of states that have 10 or 12, like Indiana, for example. And I can see, I could see California being even four states, you know, the North, San Francisco, L.A., and San Diego. And then, of course, obviously the interior would go with whatever state. But it would be an interesting topic to bring up sometime, but there has been serious talk about this. I mean, I don't want to get off on this, but I there has been some talk about it. I've read about it, Barry.
Oh, yes, there has. And, of course, the entire nation has talked from time to time about putting a big fence around California just in general, just to, you know, immunize the rest of the nation from the craziness.
Yes, there is some of that over there. There is some of that, to say the least. Well, I got to do a little musical game here with you before we get to the very serious topic of military leaders, but I got to bring this up. You know, back in 1969, on this week, you and I are old enough to remember Apollo 11, and here we are. Apollo 11 is on the moon. I think they came back. I think they came back the 24th, which would be tomorrow. But anyway, they're on the moon, and guess what the number one song in the country is, Barry?
Fly Me to the Moon.
No, in the year 2525 by Zagger and Evans.
Zagger and Evans, yes, that was a great song.
A one-hit wonder.
It was a very bleak, kind of a bleak prediction of what, you know, the world would have in store in the future. You know, it's a rather dystopian future it predicts, but it was a great song.
Yes, it is a good song, and it seems like 2525 gets closer all the time. It's only 509 years away, so it's a little closer. 509.
Yeah.
So we're actually closer to 2525 than we are to Columbus landing in America. That's scary.
Yes, it is. It is indeed. You know, it's interesting to note that when Columbus landed in the New World in 1492, the last emperor of the Roman Empire had finally died in battle just a generation before. So it's, you know, the world basically moves much quicker. Ever since Columbus discovered America, it's like we've been on a downhill slide, a roller coaster downhill, going faster and faster.
That's right. It's an interesting. Now, one more quick note, and then I know you've got an honest day in history about the Spanish Armada, but Don Henley, the great drummer as well as composer with the Eagles, was born yesterday right here in Texas. He's 67.
So that's right.
We wish him a happy birthday.
Yes, he was a Texan and a drummer, as you already noted. He met his writing partner, Glenn Frey, when both were in L.A. working for a singer named Linda Ronstadt, something we talked about last week. You know, she invited them to go on the road with her as backup musicians, and they decided instead to just form their own band, and that became the Eagles.
Right. Well, you were talking about 1492. You mentioned there was a great event, important event in world history this week, the Spanish Armada. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, and this is the week of the Spanish Armada, the Armada Battle. It was in 1588. It was a battle in which is considered by many sources or many scholars to be one of the most decisive battles in world history. The King of Spain, Felipe II, who was the most Catholic monarch, decided that he'd had enough of English pirates, essentially privateers, sponsored by Queen Elizabeth, who was a Protestant, raiding Spanish shipping. And as he was the widower of the former queen, Mary, who's Elizabeth's older sister, and he had been briefly consort of the Queen of England, he decided to come to the aid of Catholics in England who were persecuted by the Protestants, and to get away with the privateer issue once and for all by invading England. Now, this was a time when Spain was the most powerful nation in Europe. It wasn't just Spain. It was Spain. It was Austria, much of Germany, the German states, included the Netherlands, and a vast empire in the New World that had just recently been conquered in the generation before by the conquistadors. So it was the most powerful state in the world at the time. And this vast armada of ships was launched from Cadiz in western Spain and came up the Atlantic coast. And was met by the English in the English Channel, and that was the Armada Battle. And famous Englishmen like Francis Drake and John Hawkins, Admiral Howard, they met it at sea, and the English won the battle. It was a running battle, so it took several days. And the English had the advantage of having a better design of ship, faster, sleeker design called the race-built Galleon. And the English had longer and had longer range because they had better guns. They had bigger guns. They had streamlined their number of cannon down to just big guns, and this was sort of a tradition that would carry on into the next two centuries. And the English won their first great naval victory on this date in history in 1588, the Armada Battle.
Well, I guess we can maybe say that this was the military equivalent of the Fraser-Ali fights. You know, they said Fraser was
that's right.
You know, was very tough and almost like a you know a tank, whereas Ali was quick and swift and would dance around him. Maybe that's what happened many years ago. But that you know that was a big day in history. I mean, for the Spanish, I don't think they ever recovered from that, Barry.
No, they didn't. And you know, it's the Armada was defeated ultimately near Holland or Belgium. The ports they had there, Gravelines was the main battle, and the remainder of the Armada sailed north, carried on a strong wind around the north of England, around Scotland, and then was shipwrecked and destroyed finally, actually off the Irish coast, the North Irish coast. Many survived. And the Spaniards who survived made them settled in Ireland and became what is known today as the Black Irish. And it's why to this day there are many Irishmen with Spanish-sounding names. In fact, the first president of Ireland was Damon de Valera. His name, de Valera, is obviously a Spanish name.
Interesting. Well, we're going to talk about military leaders today, and we're going to break them up. I thought maybe we could break them up sort of into countries or regions. And I was wondering if we could start with the Japanese. And the reason I wanted to start with that is because just this afternoon they were showing Tora, Tora, Tora on television. And I was watching that. And, of course, on that movie, which has almost all of the makings of like a documentary, they had the names of all the big military Japanese names there. So I figured I would recognize some of them when you talk about them. So why don't we start with Japan? What did they bring to the table?
All right, well, let's start with just mentioning to the audience that World War II is the largest conflict in human history, and it's really impossible to go over in one show, particularly, you know, one sitting, 45 minutes long, to go over all the commanders. So we're just going to touch today on some of the top commanders in each country, and then there'll be many more commanders we'll talk about when their moment in the sun, so to speak, comes up later in the show. Or later in the series, you know, weeks down the road. So starting with Japan, Japan was a naval power primarily. But during the late 19th, early 20th century, their military, their army, expanded, and they began to conquer territory on the mainland of Asia. They conquered Korea, eventually Manchuria, which they took in a war against the Russians in 1905. And our main Japanese hero, if you will, won his first distinction in that war, 1905, commanding a cruiser against the Japanese, against the Russians, the Battle of Tsushima Straits. Tsushima was the big climatic battle of the Russo-Japanese War, and it put Japan on the map as a naval power. The Japanese had been tutored by the British, who at that time were the premier sailors of the world, seamen of the world, had the largest navy. And Japan became quite an accomplished naval power. This character's name, this man's name, was Admiral Yamamoto, Isoroku Yamamoto, and he was a very wise man. For one thing, he didn't want war with the United States. He had been educated at Harvard, and he had spent two tours in the United States as military attaché to the Japanese embassy in Washington D.C. And he spent a lot of his time studying the American character. And he warned Prussianly that you know, if they went to war against the United States, they would awake a sleeping giant. And of course, he wasn't wrong in that. But his career began in very early in the 20th century. And by the 1930s, he was the premier admiral in the Japanese Navy. Now, during this time, another figure rose in Japan named Tojo. Tojo was a member of a clique of officers, imperial officers in the army, that believed Japan's destiny was not going to be at sea so much as expanding into Asia. And he was pushing strongly for the war against China, which broke out in the 1930s. Yamamoto and many other in the fleet were against the war in Asia. They were against the invasion of China. And the faction fighting between Army and Navy in Japan was so bad in the late 1930s that Yamamoto had to be reassigned to the fleet from his position as a staff officer in Tokyo, because he was likely going to be killed. He'd been earmarked for assassination by the Army. That's how bad it was. So while the emperor was nominally in control of the country, Tojo and the army were really the ones who were calling the shots. And Yamamoto had to flee to the Navy. Now, during this period, it was planned to attack the United States. So Japan had come to the conclusion that their ultimate decision was to attack the United States and supplant the U.S. as the prime naval power in the Pacific. Yamamoto was against this. But he drew up plans for what we know as the Pearl Harbor attack. Now, we haven't got that far in our series, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But he was asked after the plans were drawn up whether this would win the war, and he said, probably not. He said, for the first 6 months, I'll run wild. For the next 2 or 3 years after that, it's anyone's guess. He had no confidence they would win the war. And again, as I said earlier, he warned that we were waking a sleeping giant.
Right.
Keep in mind at the time that this happened, the United States was trying to stay out of the war, and there was really no interest in going to war in the United States.
Right. It's interesting because in that movie, Tora, 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 they were showing this afternoon, when he was talking to the prime minister or to the head of Japan, I may have the wrong title, the emperor, I guess, of Japan. Yeah, and he basically said, this is all I can guarantee, meaning all he could guarantee was that they would hit these ships and make it out. But beyond that, he couldn't guarantee anything, which I think kind of ties in to what you're saying, that he knew that he could hit first, but eventually they would, the United States would come back after them. So, he knew a lot more. He knew a lot more than maybe others around him.
Well, he also predicted the only way to really beat the United States would not be simply to destroy us at sea, and not merely even occupy Hawaii, nor even take the Los Angeles and San Francisco and the West Coast. He predicted that the only way, or he said the only way that he could beat the United States would be to march inland and eventually take Washington, D.C. That's how resolved the Americans would be to continue fighting. And, of course, he said that in a way to try to discourage Japan, because he knew that would be impossible. There's no way Japan could do what I just described and in which he said. So, unfortunately for Japan, they didn't listen to him and went to war against the United States instead. There's one more Japanese commander we'll mention. His name is Yamashita. Not to be confused with Yamamoto, Yamashita, Tomoyuki Yamashita, was the best general Japan produced. Now, most Americans have never heard of Yamashita because his career was rather brief. He had always been on the outside politically when it came to the faction fighting I just described. He was an enemy and rival during the 1930s of Tojo. He was only briefly given a chance to shine, and we'll talk about that when it comes to it, but he was the man who commanded the Malaysian campaign, which swept the British out of Malaysia in very rapid fashion and captured the fortress of Singapore, for which he was called the Tiger of Malaya. All throughout the 1930s and into the 1940s even, he was advocating a complete overhaul of the Japanese military to really make it a modern fighting force, particularly a mechanized force. He was completely in keeping with the times. Unfortunately for the Japanese army was still thinking in terms of World War I. Tanks were slow, moved at the speed of the infantry. The Japanese still believed that a bayonet charge, which they called the Banzai charge, could carry the day simply by the fierceness and the determination of the attacker. They completely failed to modernize their military. Yamashita, of course, was the advocate of modernization, and as such, he ended up in the doghouse. And after Malaya, he was mostly retired.
Yeah.
So we'll get to more of his campaigns later.
Yeah, no, that's right. But I just wanted to ask you a quick question about the Japanese before we go to the next country. And again, you're right. We're just touching today on some of the highlights of these military people, and then we'll get more specifically into some of the others when we talk about battles coming up. But where did the Japanese, where did they train their military people? Did they have like a great officer school? The reason I ask you this is because, again, getting back to this movie Tora Tora that I just watched this afternoon, there seemed to be a lot of discipline in the Japanese ranks. I mean, when you look at these officers, there's a tremendous amount of discipline. And I know it's only a movie, but I bet it's probably pretty true, Barry.
Well, yes, and they were incredibly disciplined, and it's almost a crime how badly organized or badly equipped the Japanese were on land, and how badly they used the resources at sea, particularly after Pearl Harbor and Midway, because they were very good. The Japanese army, for one thing, is one of the few armies in history that actually fought the last man in several engagements, or virtually the last man. We all talk about it, you know, in throughout history here of last stands, but most of those last stands were forced upon the defenders. They wouldn't have chosen it had they had a choice. The Japanese, time and again, put themselves in positions where they had no plans ever to, you know, withdraw and fought pretty much the last man. They were incredibly brave. The Japanese Army was trained at the Imperial Japanese Army Academy, which was based on the British Academy at Sandhurst. Though many of the early trainers were German in the late 19th century. Because Japan was a medieval country up until about the time of the American Civil War, and then they modernized very rapidly. They actually took weapons that had been used in the 1500s. They were matchlocks that had been stored away by the Tokugawa shogunate in depots, because Japan was a country which had used firearms very quickly in the 16th century and became the foremost user of firearms. But then after the civil wars ended and the shogun took over, the Tokugawa shogunate established itself, the samurai class felt the guns were too devastating. They were destroying the social order of Japan. And so the shogun collected all the guns and stored them away, and they went back to swords and bows and spears, until the 19th century, when they were forced to modernize by the European and American powers coming to Japan. So they took those old matchlocks and they basically retooled them into muskets, into rifled muskets in the 1860s, putting a percussion cap instead of a matchlock. And then later, by 1905, they had actually turned some of these into bolt-action rifles.
Wow.
So it's just amazing what Japan was able to do with these antique weapons by modernizing them.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was Japanese army. The Navy was trained in the equivalent of Annapolis. It was the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy. So, and plus they had a Naval Staff College, and they were organized just the same as the Americans and the British, with a very modern army.
Yes. And those ships that they had, at least to attack Pearl Harbor, were pretty pretty impressive warships, at least on that, I mean, I'm just basing myself on, you know, that movie, which is probably pretty pretty true. Well, let's do this. What country would you like to do next?
Well, since we're talking about the Axis, let's go on and talk about the Germans.
Let's do it.
By the way, we're going to skip the Italians, because while there were some Italians of some note, they really were second grade and a second-rate power compared to the Germans. So we're going to talk in this brief amount of time about the Germans in European theater. There were lots of German commanders which were actually higher up in rank than the ones we're going to talk about right now. But since Hitler, for the most part, was his own supreme commander, at least from 1941 on, late 41 on, when he fired all of his top generals, I'm going to talk about the ones who really were superstars throughout the war. The first one we've already mentioned in the last episode, or actually two episodes ago, when we talked about the Battle of France. This was the guy who was the more or less the architect of that victory. And his name was Erich von Manstein. Von Manstein was a staff officer in 1940. He drew up the plans for the Battle of France. It was an unorthodox plan. And it led to the complete collapse of France in a matter of weeks, as opposed to what had happened in 1914, which was a war that dragged on for years. His plan was, of course, a concentrated panzer thrust south of the Meuse River, crossing the river and cutting off the entire British and French forces in Belgium. It was magnificently successful. Manstein then went on throughout the war to become Germany's most successful strategist and commander, mostly on the Eastern Front. Thank God we never had to face Manstein in the West. We always faced second-rate commanders by comparison. But he was a consummate strategist. Unfortunately for the Germans, and fortunately for the Allies, his talents were mostly wasted because the Russians just had so much material on the East, and Hitler kept interfering with all his plans. But you could easily see, as we talk about the Germans throughout the coming weeks, that there were many places they had a chance to win the war had Hitler just not interfered with his generals, many of which were the quality of Manstein.
Yeah.
The next one is Heinz Guderian. I'm going very rapidly to this, but Guderian was also somebody we talked about last week. He was the one who actually led the Panzer thrust through France in 1940. He's called the father of Panzer warfare because his writings, particularly his writing in a book called Achtung Panzer, which means attention tank, was the most influential writing piece and the most influential thought on Panzer warfare in the 1930s. He's the one who came up with the concept of a combined arms division, which today, you know, we take this for granted because all American and you know, modern day fighting forces are combined arms, meaning infantry, armor, aircraft, everything is combined into one command package. So a commander has at his disposal artillery can call in, armor for breakthrough and exploitation, and then the infantry can keep up with the armor by being armored vehicles of their own. All this was brand new in 1940. And in the 1930s, it was Guderian who came up with this idea. He's by the way, it's called Hurry Up Heinz, Heinz Guderian, Hurry Up Heinz, because he's always telling his troops, hurry up, get moving. And that's the kind of commander he was. He was like Totten. He was always on the move. By the way, he was a cavalry commander before the war, back in the early 1900s, as was George Patton. And it's interesting that we're going to talk about this war. Most of the most successful commanders who became great tank commanders actually began their career as cavalry leaders, and they applied some of those lessons, you know, to the tank and to mobile warfare.
You would think that maybe some of these guys, Barry, actually fought each other in World War One, you know, when they were obviously in lower positions.
Entirely possible.
Yeah.
Though it's important to note, too, that Italy, which was an ally of Germany, was on both sides in World War One. They started off on the side of one, then they changed sides. They started off as an Axis ally, or a Central Powers ally, and then late in World War One they switched sides. So the next man we're going to talk about actually won the highest award Germany had to offer and got his first experience fighting against the Italians in the Alps. He was a commander of Alpine forces during World War One. His name was Erwin Rommel. Rommel is called the Desert Fox because he won his most famous victories against the British in North Africa, which we'll get to in probably the next episode. But Rommel was another one of these great Panzer leaders. He was incredibly popular with Hitler, possibly one of Hitler's most popular generals. He commanded Hitler's bodyguard unit, his escort detachment. In the 1930s, and that's how he came to Hitler's attention. He was never of the stature as far as organizational skills or rose to the highest level like Guderian did or Manstein. But as far as army commanders, he was possibly Germany's greatest. He was much respected by the Allies. Winston Churchill even said of him that he was a gallant opponent. Unlike most of the Nazi officers and German officers we faced, after the war, he was not vilified. Of course, he was dead by that point, which helped. But Rommel won the Pour le Mérite, the Blue Max, the highest award for courage, sort of their version of the Medal of Honor, as a commander of Alpine forces, ski troops in the Alps during World War One, and by almost his battalion almost single-handedly caused the collapse of the entire northern section of the Italian front. By outflanking it and surrounding the northern flank and causing it to collapse at the greatest battle that that portion of the war called Caporetto. In 1940, we talked about the Battle of France. He commanded the 7th Panzer Division, and his thrust across northern France brought him into contact with the British, who were retreating at that time into Normandy, the Highland Division. And the British counterattacked at a place called Arras in northern France. And Rommel found that his tanks were inferior in a duel with the heavier British tanks. So he brought up his aviation battalion, or I'm sorry, his anti-aircraft battalion, what they call the FLAC battalion, which had a gun called the 88. The 88 was a very long-range anti-aircraft cannon. And he ordered the gunners to level the anti-aircraft guns, so instead of firing into the air, they're firing at level to the ground and use them as anti-tank weapons. And because of the optics of these things, which are meant to shoot planes out of the sky at high altitude, they had tremendous range on the battlefield and tremendous penetrating power. And these 88s were just the terror of World War II.
Wow.
And Rommel was the first general to use these in battle in that fashion.
Interesting. Let me ask you a quick question before we take a break, and then we'll come back with the Americans and some of the others. When I know they were enemies, obviously, these were enemies of the United States during the war, but when we teach military tactics at the war schools, whatever war schools, do we study the tactics of some of these Germans? Because it sounds to me like they were brilliant.
They really were, and I've never attended West Point or VMI, Virginia Military Tech, but I imagine they do. Certainly, the battles of World War II are studied, and you can't study World War II without studying the German component. I recommend to the audience reading a book called The Desert Fox by Desmond Young, the biography of Rommel, and a book written by Manstein himself called Lost Victories. That was Manstein's biography, at least his World War II biography. And finally, another book called Panzer Battles by a general named von Mellenthin, who was Rommel's chief of staff. Those three books will tell you more about what the Germans did in World War II and from their perspective, from the German perspective. Guderian, by the way, also wrote a book called Panzer Leader. Not as well written as the other ones, but certainly very informative.
Yes, absolutely. We'll have to put a link to that on the show information or on the blog or whatever. I just thought this was an interesting note before we go on break. You know, my friend Bruce, who I think is also a friend of yours on Facebook, just sent me a little note here. You know, we talked about Zager and Evans in the year 2525, and he's telling me that apparently Zager, after he recorded that song, became a very successful guitar designer. And a lot of people like his guitars, and I thought it was interesting that we got this guy from Bruce. I want to thank Bruce for updating me. I didn't know that Zager and Evans had any future after that song, but I guess they did. They started making guitars. So thank you, Bruce, for that note. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back with more of the military leaders right after this. Silvio Canto, let's get back to our conversation with our good friend Barry Jacobson. I was just going to say one more thing about Zager and Evans. I guess if you're a one-hit wonder, you can always do something musical after you have your one moment in the sun there, Barry.
That's right.
That's right.
I didn't know that. Thank you, Bruce, for informing me.
Yeah, that was great.
Just a one-shot kind of deal.
Yeah, that was a one-hit wonder. If there was ever a one-hit wonder, that was it.
One thing a lot of people don't understand about these one-hit wonders is back in the 1960s and probably the 1950s as well, studio writers would write songs, and then the record companies would find musicians and put together a band that really didn't exist other than just to do this one song. And they'd give it a name, and they'd give it an identity, and if it was successful, they'd promote them, and sometimes they'd go on and do maybe one or two other songs. But a lot of these one-hit wonders weren't really bands to begin with. They were simply doing a song that had been written by someone else for the record label.
I think the Archies and Sugar Sugar may have been a good example of that. That was purely a studio band, of course, the cartoon series, Sugar. I mean, the cartoon series Archie's, but the band itself was not really a band. They were just put together there in the studio. But anyway, let's get back to our story. We have Germans, we have Japanese. Where would you like to go next?
Well, let's go on to the Allies and start with the Russians, because we're going to spend more time with the Americans than any other group, for all the obvious reasons. But let's talk about the Russians. The Russians produced many great generals, but we're only going to talk about one, who was their chief general, their most successful and probably famous general outside of Russia. And his name was Marshal Zhukov, Georgi Zhukov. Much like Patton, Zhukov had been a cavalry commander. He was somebody who served in World War I as a junior officer. And at the end of World War I, when the Bolshevik Revolution came about, followed quickly by a civil war in Russia between the White Russians and the Reds, he joined the Red Army as a commander of cavalry, and very soon after was a member of the Communist Party. He came from a very poor background, from a peasant background, and while he never would have advanced very, very far in the Tsarist army for that reason, because he had no aristocracy, aristocratic background, no connections. His poor background actually was a plus in the new communist regime. He rose very rapidly during the Civil War, and by the 1930s had risen the rank of general. He was one of those guys who, like Patton, saw that tanks were the new cavalry, that the armored forces could take the place of cavalry as the mobile arm in battle. And he got a chance to test this in the late 1930s when Japan and Russia in 1939 got into a border skirmish in Manchuria, which was to have far-reaching consequences. The Japanese pushed into the Russian section of the border, crossed the border, and Zhukov was in command at that point of the Russian forces along that section. He had only two tank brigades, but he stopped the Japanese with his infantry in the center, and with a brigade on either flank, far out to the flank, in fact, he was able to encircle the entire Japanese attacking army and capture or annihilate it using mobile tactics, which would be these pincer movements that would become the hallmark of Zhukov's tactics later on in the war, primarily and most famously at Stalingrad. You hold them in the center, engage them in the center in a battle, and then hit them on both flanks and break through and encircle them. After that, he was promoted to chief of staff of the Russian army back in Moscow. Why was this battle so important, the Battle of Khalkhin Gol? Because after that, the Japanese became gun-shy about fighting the Russians. One of the great questions of World War II is, why didn't the Japanese help the Germans by putting pressure on the Russians in Manchuria and in Siberia, which they could have done? And the reason is because Zhukov had bloodied their nose so badly in 1939 that they won no part of a land war against the Russians at that point. Mm-hmm. Partially also because the Japanese had never modernized their army as Yamashita had asked for, had called for. And so they were just mm-hmm. unprepared to fight a mobile war in the vast expanses of Asia.
Yeah.
So it's a very important battle.
Sure. Go ahead. I was going to ask you a question, but go ahead. No, I was going to ask you
please,
that.
No, please.
You know, when you, you know, when you read about World War II, you read about the atrocities that the Russian soldiers committed, you know, when they would rape women and all of that. Do you think that's fair that we should talk about them that way? Or I'm sure that probably happened in other wars too. But do you think that's fair on the Russians who were very brave in other ways?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, apologists for the Russians, apologists for the communist regime in general. Have tried to dismiss some of the more lurid tales that came out of the end of World War II of what the Russians did in Germany. Although, and Germans have played it up, saying that indeed it did happen. I think it's likely that tales are true. I think it's very likely that the Russians, probably because of what had occurred when the Germans invaded Russia, though never on the scale that Russians perpetrated it, the Russians wanted a measure of revenge. And a Russian minister of propaganda during the war, which, and by the way, keep in mind that a lot of the soldiers that invaded Germany by 1945 were not ethnically Russian. They were ethnically Asian. They were mostly Mongols and Kalmucks, a lot of Siberians. The European Russians have been bled white during the war against the Germans, and by 45, a large number of those troops were from the Asian parts of the Soviet Union. And in many ways, they weren't any more enlightened, than they had been during the time of Genghis Khan. And the atrocities they committed against the women of Eastern Europe were not much different than what the Mongols had done when the Mongols invaded, back in the 13th century. So I think it's fair. It's brutal. Now, is it fair to criticize them for that? Sure. Is it understandable? Yeah, it is. Kind of understandable considering what they'd gone through. These troops are Siberians. These were not Europeans that had been educated in the 20th century. These were men whose outlook wasn't much different than it had been during the time of Attila the Hun.
Right, yeah, and they probably figured, hey, we won, so we get the spoils of victory. I mean that in a weird sort of way, but they figured, whoever wins gets to have the spoils of victory. Isn't that kind of the idea?
Well, yeah, in fact, I started to say this. A minister of propaganda in the Soviet Union had broadcast on Soviet radio many times and promised the Russian troops, the Red Army, which again with these Mongols and Siberians, what have you, that their spoils of war would be the women of Germany, that they would be given the women of Germany as their spoils of war. So sort of a motivating factor. It's very ugly, but there's probably some truth there.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Well, I guess we have the Allies or the Americans next.
Yes, we do. Oh, by the way, last thing about Zhukov is he had been, even though he had been chief of staff of the Russian Army, the Red Army, in 1940, he had been dismissed by Stalin and sent to a lesser post out in Siberia because he disagreed with Stalin on one matter or another. And thus he missed the German invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa, which we haven't gotten to yet. Which led to the collapse of the Red Army initially, and Russia nearly collapsing entirely, and the Germans arrived on the gates of Moscow. And it was Zhukov, as we'll see later on, who was then recalled and put back in charge, that was able to stem the German tide.
Excellent.
So that's Zhukov. We'll talk more about him when the time comes.
Yeah.
All right, so the Americans. Let's talk about
the
Eisenhower.
Yeah, let's go to the Americans.
Well, Eisenhower is the consummate staff general. He fought in World War One as a junior officer. I'm sorry, he didn't fight in World War One. He was a junior officer in World War One, but never saw combat. Something he was behind the scenes snarked at by people like Montgomery, who had fought in World War One. He was a staff officer who spent the entire war back in World War One organizing training camps for American troops and training facilities for our American officers, because the American Army expanded very rapidly between 1916 and 1918. And Eisenhower, as a young officer, was one of the guys charged with being back home to keep that kind of production line of soldiers moving. In between the wars, his career was very interesting. He was always a staff officer, and one of his most notable staff positions was as adjutant and chief of staff to the guy who was considered to be the most successful Army officer in America at the time. That was Douglas MacArthur, who we'll talk about next. Eisenhower was the complete polar opposite of MacArthur. Eisenhower was self-effacing, down-to-earth, genuine in every sense of the word, unstinting in his praise of others, never wanted to hog the glory for himself. If you had to look for an admirable man to be your friend, that would be Eisenhower. And a completely competent staff officer. MacArthur, on the other hand, as we'll talk about in a minute, was the grand guggenal general, right out of opera. Everything you imagine a general to be, both good and bad. Eisenhower later said, "I studied dramatics under MacArthur." And MacArthur said the best clerk I ever had was Eisenhower.
Right. I wonder what happened when Eisenhower was elected president and now all of a sudden Marshall had a commander-in-chief,
Well, yeah. But of course, by that point, MacArthur had been fired after Korea.
Right,
Harry Truman. And
right.
Was planning on running for president as a Republican, but instead his campaign fizzled out. As it turned out, he had very little political skill. And Eisenhower became the man who was elected instead in 1952. So the rivalry went all the way right up until 1952, when Eisenhower gained the nomination instead of MacArthur.
But I want to correct myself. I said Marshall. I meant I'm in MacArthur. A minute ago,
MacArthur.
I said Marshall. I meant MacArthur. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. So MacArthur, you know, why did he become chief commander in Europe? Because he was very much trusted by George Marshall. And then in the late 1930s, George Marshall was chief of staff of the army. And he sent Eisenhower over with Hap Arnold, who was, we'll talk about just real briefly in just a few minutes, who was the commander of the American Air Force, the Army Air Corps, sent him over to Europe in 1942 to see how the preparations for, you know, for producing a joint command were going between the British and the Americans. And Cheney, General Cheney, was commander of the American forces in Britain at the time, getting ready to assume command as the American overall commander in Europe. And Hap Arnold and Eisenhower came back, said he's not doing a very good job. And they outlined what really needed to be done. And so the president, Roosevelt, and George Marshall, the chief of staff, decided that this guy Eisenhower, who's a real genius, his organization, needs to be the guy in Britain. So they sent him over to England, and he began organizing what would later become the headquarters for the Supreme Allied Commander, which he would become very shortly by 1942. So that was Eisenhower. He was really a political general and a staff officer more than a battle commander. But it turned out to be exactly what we needed to lead what was to be called the Grand Crusade in Europe.
Yeah. It seems to me that Eisenhower was in the right place over 20 years. I mean, first of all, as the commander in World War II, and then in what I think was a pretty successful two-term presidency. I think he gets better over the years, because a lot of people look back at it now and said, you know, this guy, he was pretty good. He was pretty good. He wasn't flashy, but that's what the country needed in 1950s after, you know, after the war. There was a big population boom, and I think the country sort of needed a steady hand, and he provided that, Barry, I think.
Well, did you ever see the film Ben-Hur, made in the 1950s with Charles Heston?
Yes, with Charles Heston. Sure, that's a great movie, yeah.
You know, the famous scene where he is learning to ride the chariot, and of course he's already a charioteer, but he's taking his Arab stallions out on a practice run in the desert, and Arab stallions are famously finicky and difficult to control, very headstrong, beautiful horses, magnificent horses, but difficult to control. And it takes a master to balance out that team, make that team work as a team, and that was Eisenhower. He learned from MacArthur how to handle difficult men with huge egos. And when he talked about Montgomery, the British commander, he talked about Patton and all the other lesser commanders, you have not only two brilliant commanders, but very headstrong and egotistical men. And Eisenhower was just the perfect man to control that chariot team of allies and make them work as a team.
Yeah. No, I think so. And it's interesting to me, again, talking about Eisenhower, how during his presidency, he really kept the country out of war. There were some opportunities for the United States to be engaged in war, the Suez Canal, and yet he was I kind of get the feeling he didn't want to put the country in a war unless it was necessary. And other people may have gotten us into a war, but he really kept a steady hand. I mean, that's why I like him so much.
A lot to like about Ike. In fact, that was slogan at the 1952 convention was, I like Ike.
I like Ike. That's exactly right, the slogan. I guess the great question. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to move very rapidly through this.
No,
I understand.
Yes.
I'm ready to move on. Ed MacArthur begins World War II as the most famous general in the American Army. He's already retired by that point from being chief of staff of the Army, and was over in the Philippines advising the Filipino Army, which was newly being formed as Philippines had gained their independence from the United States, though part of the Commonwealth. He is the son of a Civil War general named Arthur MacArthur, who had fought in the Civil War and then later had been a hero of the Philippine insurrection at the turn of the 20th century. So MacArthur's family had deep roots in the Philippines. MacArthur in World War I was our most successful general. He became chief of staff of the army in the 1920s. He was, you know, as much an actor as he was a general in many ways. He played the part of a general perfectly. By the way, he was first of his class at West Point. Everything he did, he excelled at. There was no more celebrated general in American history at the time, probably than MacArthur. When World War II breaks out, he's in the Philippines, and so he's appointed by Roosevelt as Supreme Commander in the Pacific, a title he will share with Admiral Nimitz, but he is our most celebrated commander. And again, you know, he's dramatic, he's flamboyant, he's a publicity hound, but he was every inch the general, and when it came right down to it, quite a brilliant one. His island hopping campaign, along with Nimitz, did the same thing, of course, but his island hopping campaign was very well conducted. He was incredibly inspirational to the troops. After being driven out of the Philippines, he famously said, "I shall return." And just things like that gave heart to America at a time when we really needed it. And
right.
Of course, he lived up to his promise. He did return to the Philippines and liberate the country after the Japanese drove him out in 1942.
And after he was fired by President Truman, he was given quite a welcome back in the United States, as I recall reading. I mean, he even spoke to Congress, which is kind of in your face, President Truman, but that's what happened.
Rather like Netanyahu being brought over to talk in front of Congress after he was snubbed by President Obama. Yeah, very similar. And of course, he when he retired, he famously said, "Old soldiers never die, they simply fade away." And he did. Dying in the 1960s.
That's
now,
right.
I mentioned Hap Arnold. I mentioned Hap Arnold. I'm just going to touch real briefly on Hap Arnold because Henry Arnold was the father of the American Air Force. He is the only man in American history to not only be a five-star general, which are only a handful, only I think three or four other ones, but he was a five-star general in two different branches. First, the Army Air Corps. So he was an Army five-star general, and then it became the five-star general that began the American Air Force when it broke off after World War II and became a separate branch. Interesting enough, he's also the founder of Pan American Airways and the RAND Corporation think tank. This is a guy that learned to fly from the Wright brothers himself. He learned to fly at the very beginning of aviation.
Wow.
This guy goes way back. And, in fact, he was one of the things that he's famous for is he took America from a pre-flight America and developed the American Air Force along with a guy named Billy Mitchell at a time when really there was the military wasn't sure how to use airplanes correctly. And Billy Mitchell showed them that bombers could actually sink ships and that aviation shouldn't be just a land branch, it should also be a naval branch. And Hap Arnold had a big part of that as well. So he's quite an influential guy at this time.
That is very interesting. I was going to say, as you keep mentioning these names, I think of all these ships that are named after them, you know, the Nimitz. I think you're going to mention Nimitz sometime, either today
well,
or during
No,
or
Nimitz,
later.
We're talking about Nimitz right now. Now Nimitz, we're going to go over quickly because Nimitz is a oddly pale character. He was a brilliant staff officer, but his career was fairly unremarkable. He advanced from one station to the next, moved right up the chain. By World War II, by December 7th, 1941, when the war breaks out, he is in a perfect position, high up in the Naval Department, in the Naval Bureau of Naval Affairs, to get promoted when a bunch of other admirals who've been in charge were being fired because of the debacle of Pearl Harbor. 10 days after the attack, he was promoted by Roosevelt to be CINCPAC, commander of the Pacific Fleet, promoted to rear admiral. During the war, he would command the Central Pacific, while MacArthur commanded the South Pacific. And you could argue, and I think it's a pretty good argument, that his strategy was much more effective than MacArthur's. His strategy was basically to bypass and ignore all the islands they didn't have to take and just strike directly across the Pacific right for Japan until we get within bombing range, you know, which basically would be Okinawa, Iwo Jima and Okinawa, capture those and then begin bombing Japan from them. And that's exactly what he did. Very successful. And, of course, the Nimitz-class aircraft carrier is named after Chester Nimitz.
That's right. That's right. And the Bradley tanks, that's another of these generals that we'll talk about. I am so happy that you had a lot to say today because with my allergies, I would have had a very hard time keeping up with you talking today. So I'm so happy that you had a lot to say today. And do we have any others? We don't have a lot of time left, but is there any
more? Well, we're almost out of time. So, Let me just do one more. I was going to do Montgomery.
Sure.
Let's skip Montgomery until we get to 1942 when he actually appears on the stage in a big way. Let's just talk about George Patton. And you could say we could talk about Patton when he appears, but he's going to show up pretty quick anyway. Patton is my favorite general of World War II, as he is many's. Like MacArthur, he is a consummate figure as a commander. If you got to go to central casting and cast somebody to be a general in a movie, you pick either MacArthur or Patton. He got his start as a cavalry officer. He was the oldest serving officer in the United States Army except for MacArthur when World War II began. And you could say he was actually older than MacArthur because MacArthur had resigned by that point to go to the Philippines. He graduated West Point in 1911 and was an Olympic fencer, went to the Olympic Games in 1912, competing in the military pentathlon. And but for some questionable scoring in the pistol competition, he probably would have won a bronze medal. He was such a great fencer that he went back to become master of the sword at West Point, where he became an instructor, and invented the last cavalry sword ever designed for the U.S. Cavalry called the Patton Sword. And it had a very unique design that he had himself pioneered. Shortly thereafter, in 1915, young Mr. Patton, young Lieutenant Patton, became an aide-de-camp of Blackjack Pershing, the guy who would later command American forces in World War One. He went to Mexico in the expedition that chased after Pancho Villa, the famous bandit who had crossed the border in 1916 and raided into New Mexico, the border town of Columbus. And the Americans pursued him across the border. Patton famously got in a gun duel with three of Pancho Villa's lieutenants. Patton was a famous sort of cowboy general, and he really showed his cowboy roots in this expedition. He tracked down three of Villa's aides, lieutenants, and they put up a resistance when he tried to arrest them. And like some Wyatt Earp at the OK Corral, Patton pulled his pistols and shot three of them and brought them in.
Right.
He's quite a colorful character, Patton.
To say the least, right. And then he was killed in a car accident, right, later in his life, yeah.
That's right. The end of World War II, in the summer after World War II, he was killed in a freak accident, fatally injured. He died later in the hospital, later.
Mm.
Real briefly, he went to World War I, commanded the 1st American Tank Unit in World War I. Between the wars, Patton was a proponent of tank warfare, armored warfare. He made a lot of enemies. He made a few influential friends as well. He's a guy that helped Eisenhower get through the staff college. Eisenhower was having a very tough time when he went through the staff college in the 1930s. And Patton, who is a friend who corresponded regularly with Eisenhower, helped him with his studies. And that might be one of the reasons that Eisenhower never completely lost faith with Patton, despite the fact that Patton really stepped on it a couple times.
Yes.
And he got spanked for it.
That's right. I was just going to say that if you have not seen that movie Patton, you should. That is a great movie. Of all of the military generals and all the movies over the years, that George C. Scott playing Patton is just one fantastic movie, Barry.
It really is. It won many Academy Awards. George C. Scott so inhabited the role of Patton that when people see the real Patton and they see him, hear him talk in some of the televised speeches, we kind of reject it because that's not the Patton we know. The Patton we know is George C. Scott.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. But anyway, I think we're going to have to wrap it up today. But man, this was great. I'm so happy that we did this show, and we went a little longer than usual. But I really wanted to get everybody in, make sure we gave everybody a minute. But what a great show! I want to thank you again. You have such amazing knowledge, Barry. I don't know what else to say. You must be a walking encyclopedia, as they used to say in school.
Well, in fact, that was my nickname in school. I have a weird memory. I can't remember my Social Security number some days, but I don't forget things like this. So
that's
go figure.
Right. Well, we're delighted that you don't forget things like these because we love talking to you. But again, have a wonderful weekend. And briefly, where are we going to go in the next program?
Well, if the audience remembers, we left it off at the end of the Battle of Britain. So
we're
going to begin with is the German Africa Corps, the battle in which Rommel comes to light as the great hero of Germany, as Germany fights Britain in North Africa.
That's right. So we're still in 1941. We haven't gotten to Pearl Harbor yet. That'll be coming
up.
Probably a couple of shows down the road. Barry, have a great weekend in San Diego, and we'll talk to you hopefully very soon.
I look forward to it. Take care, Silvio.
All right, thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, what a great show today, talking about World War II and the military generals. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.